This is John Udell. I got together today with Steve Vanosky. He's a middleware expert who recently left Iona to join a startup company. The company's in stealth mode, so we couldn't talk about that. Instead, I asked Steve to reflect on his long experience with distributed software, from the Corba era all the way through to modern web services. Steve Vanosky, this is very exciting, joining us from an undisclosed location somewhere on the East Coast. To not discuss the new startup venture, but rather to reflect on the past. In particular, I thought one of the things that we could talk about would be the W3C workshop on web services for the enterprise, is I think what it's called.
Yeah, coming up at the end of the month.
I was wondering what you thought about that. I wanted to go, but you have to give a position paper in order to go, and I am not the one to do that on behalf of Microsoft. And in fact, I don't think Microsoft is even sending a representative to this, but I know that you're aware of what's going on there. What's your take on what that has been convened to do?
My understanding is that people like Eric Newcomer had been talking to Tim Berners-Lee.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's been this battle, of course, between kind of the REST people and the web people versus the enterprise distributed computing people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been going on for a few years.
A battle that neither you nor I sees much of a point to.
There are certainly differences in approaches, but sitting there saying, hey, this is the way to do it. No, this is the way to do it. Doesn't really buy you much.
Yeah. Yeah.
At the end of the day. So the question really became, you know, should the W3C, which is, of course, charged with taking care of the web standard, should they be involved in enterprise standards? And I think that's one of the main questions this workshop has to answer. The other thing is, enterprise software is what it is. You know, you just can't go in there and say, hey, guys, all that stuff that you've been using all these years, you have to throw away now, and the right way to do it is this other way. Obviously isn't going to happen. And so there has to be, here's where we are today, and here's where we think we can get to tomorrow, but how do we, you know, actually get there?
What do you think that the term enterprise standards means? Is it really necessarily a completely separate category from, and what is the other category, right? What is the non-enterprise standards category? What label would you attach to that?
Right.
Regular stuff? I mean, you know, like what, right? It's kind of odd when you think about it.
Yeah, it is odd. And I don't really like using the terms because it sort of implies, you know, the enterprise way is this much better way and the people doing that stuff are obviously much better developers and architects, and, you know, it kind of puts down, in a way, the whatever non-enterprise means.
Well, yeah, and so, for example, if you sort of pick that term apart and try to see what the connotations are, one of them, I think, has been this terribly overloaded and abused term, scalability.
Yes.
But yet, you know, I think it was Joe Gregorio that had on his blog a couple of weeks ago this great little nugget about how it used to be the case that if you delivered an application that was used by 300,000 people, you'd reach the pinnacle of your career as an enterprise software architect. He said, now, 300,000 people, you're just ready to get your second round of funding and leave your parents' garage, right? I mean, you know.
Yeah. Very true.
The tenets of what enterprise software was supposed to mean have been turned on their head, right? At the same time, there's a lot of stuff in there, as we know, that hasn't yet made its way into the sort of open web application space. But from my point of view, there's no reason ultimately why it couldn't and it shouldn't. And I just wonder about this whole distinction going forward, if it's really important or useful.
First of all, what we call enterprise today really involves more like legacy. Here's these systems, and in my background, you know, working with customers in telecommunications, finance, manufacturing, you know, they've had these systems running for sometimes 20 years or more, right?
Right.
And they sometimes no longer have the source code. Seen Corba systems, for example, where they've lost the original IDL. So they don't really know what the interfaces are. The developers that built these systems have long since moved on. They've just been rolling along in production.
Right.
And so I think a lot of times when we talk about enterprise software, it's actually that stuff. You know, it's stuff that's been running the business, it's critical, and it can't be thrown out and just kind of replaced with something that's brand new and hasn't yet been proven.
Mm-hmm.
The other interesting thing, I think, is within the enterprise, I mean, if we're talking about kind of REST versus SOAP or, you know, REST versus WS Star or whatever, within the enterprise, you've certainly seen the growth of the web as well. There's really no company probably on the planet that doesn't have its own internal web where they get a lot of stuff done. They have systems integrated using the web. They have a lot of critical data on the web. And one of the arguments is always that you have, well, the web is a human thing where you're sitting on one end with a browser and you're directing everything. And that's why it doesn't really apply to this enterprise problem of communicating applications. But that's not really true. I mean, even at Iona, I had written applications that were completely web-based for internal purposes.
Sure.
Processes or applications communicating with each other. So that's not really a valid argument. So while we've seen this, you know, this argument around enterprises, like there's a wall between them, and on this side it's all legacy stuff, and on that side it's the World Wide Web, but that's not really true. You know, there's web inside the enterprise as well.
In fact, the web inside the enterprise can have this nice property, as can the web outside the enterprise, of mixing the notion of communicating applications and human interface, which is sort of, to me, it's always been the key. Because at the end of the day, people have to intervene in these processes. And so integration by URL is not only a nice way to tie software components together, but it's a way to provide hooks for people to jump in and interact with the system at various points. To my mind, it's always been the best of both worlds. So I've had a hard time understanding what the problem was. I think that's because I never made a huge distinction. You know, as the WS Star stuff emerged, I never made a huge distinction between that and what we now call the REST style. Though, of course, the toolkits that emerged did. And the toolkits kind of pushed people very much in the direction of doing things from a programmatic perspective with object style and RPC style interfaces. You know, but then we, you know, we sort of went through a phase of people reminding one another that, well, it wasn't only that, right? And, you know, in particular, I think Sam Ruby at IBM did a great job of sort of deconstructing that and showing people that, look, this SOAP request, which is accessed by a URL using an HTTP GET with a very simple XML payload, is just not all that different fundamentally from the same thing that just happens to do XML over HTTP and kick back a different shaped packet.
You're right about the toolkit angle, and I think that part is really huge. What happens is, you know, there's a developer given a task to have something talking to something else. They look around, depending on their background, within the enterprise, almost certainly this developer is going to go look at some web services toolkit. They're probably a Java developer, so they're potentially looking at JaxWS or, in the past, JaxRPC or something along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
So there's various standards in that area, and, you know, they just say, well, what's the kind of the easiest thing I could do? And it's very much a developer focus. You know, how can I just stay in my kind of insular world of Java and write code that just happens to go across the network and call this application or give this application some data or whatever it's trying to do?
Yeah.
It's a very short-term view, but it's very hard to convince people that if you were to look at the bigger picture and look at all the problems that, I mean, that's essentially RPC, and we've known for years about the problems with RPC.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when you start encoding objects on the wire, the brittleness, the versioning problems, the, you know, just myriad problems that come out of that approach, you kind of go and try to convince them, you know, this isn't really the best long-term solution. And they might say, well, my schedule is such that I don't really have a choice. Or they might say, well, that's a long-term problem. I don't know that I'm going to be here for the long term. I don't really care. I mean, you know, you have... It's interesting because you can go speak about this topic at a conference and everybody's head in the audience nods, yes, that's exactly right. And then they turn around and say, okay, back to real work. All right, where's that JaxWS spec?
So there are conferences that you go to where everyone's head is in that space and the other stuff, you know, the web of services, in the sense that I think that this workshop is convening to discuss. You know, that seems highly suspicious. And, you know, you can go to other conferences where it's completely the other way. And what's been incredibly frustrating to me, being one of these kind of middle ground folks, like I think you are too, is to say, look, folks, I mean, you know, why do we have to make this an either or thing, right? These things really are complementary. You know, I think it's kind of sad that we can't proceed with that assumption and just get on with it, you know? So I don't know, maybe that's part of what this workshop is intended to accomplish.
Well, the workshop, I was originally supposed to be actually the first speaker. Eric Newcomer is one of the co-chairs, and Eric, of course, is the CTO at Iona.
Yeah.
And Ken Lasky is another co-chair. He's from MITRE. So when I left Iona, Eric said, gee, you know, if you really want to, I said, well, I can't do that talk anymore. And he said, well, if you really want to, you can. And I said, well, it wouldn't be right for me to be speaking as someone from Iona when I'm really not. And so I think Eric's going to give that talk, but he said, well, you're still welcome at the workshop, mm-hmm. which was very nice. You know, the three chairs kind of kept me on the list. So I may go anyway.
Well, since we've got you here, though, why don't you give us a version of what you would have said there?
What I would have said is a lot along the lines of what we've just said, the fact that it doesn't have to be an either-or. You know, there are these concerns in the enterprise around mainly legacy systems and different protocols and tying systems together based on those protocols and data formats and things that are not really going to go away. Those are real concerns. They have very significant business impact.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't just take a high ground from a sort of technical purity perspective and say, well, you know, that's the old way of doing things. The new way is this REST way, and it's proven to be scalable, and it's much better, so everyone should just switch to it. That being said, there also is this kind of a force that I've described, I think, in the enterprise with that developer sitting there with the spec saying, well, this is the easiest way I can do this. I'm sticking to it.
Mm-hmm.
They really need to kind of get out more and realize that there is this huge distributed system sitting right inside, you know, they're looking at it in their browser. It's very successful. And it didn't happen by accident, and it doesn't, it's not because it's human-driven. You know, that's a common argument.
Yeah.
So they really need to look at the techniques that are used there. The, you know, Roy Fielding's thesis that coined the term REST is very readable. There's no reason they can't sit down and read that, understand the architectural constraints behind REST, and start to apply those to the kind of work you're doing inside the enterprise. So that's kind of the position that we had taken at Iona.
Mm-hmm.
That would been the position that I would present, and I think that's what Eric's going to present.
Mm-hmm.
Ken Lasky, as I said, was one of the co-chairs. He sent an email to the group yesterday, I believe, and basically said, we want to make sure this workshop does not get bogged down in the REST versus SOAP. The workshop is really, according to his mail, is really about improving enterprise software.
Right.
What are the things that maybe REST doesn't offer that you need in the enterprise? Could we talk about those? Can we look at that? But there's no industry leadership around that.
Let me run something by you, because I think that there is very much an aspect to this which is not only about keeping those legacy systems chugging along, but is about going forward, how you imbue modern systems with the kinds of characteristics that those systems have. And that does, in my view, require a lot of elements of what's been woven into the WS Star stack. The way I tend to think about it is that you can do a lot of simple point-to-point stuff in the REST style, and you should. But what you also eventually need, and or in some cases will need, is the ability to intermediate those systems, because eventually it's not just point-to-point. It becomes a fabric. A communicating fabric of services. And at that level, you need to be able to control things in a policy-driven way, where the policy is asserted over communication that flows through arbitrary sets of communicating endpoints. The best example that I have seen so far is in the security space, where you start to see some of these vendors like Layer 7 and those guys actually doing this stuff. And the idea there is, It's really all the magic is in the SOAP header. That is the place where you get to layer on security policies and reliability policies and things like that. What I think hasn't emerged very clearly is how can there be a smooth transition, right? In other words, how can you sort of start out doing the simple point-to-point thing, but do it in a way that gracefully can accommodate this intermediation when or if you need to add that on? Because I think the way it looks to me right now is that if you thought you might want that ultimately, then you would have to start in a pure sort of WS Star style, which would in fact be overkill for a lot of people because they might never get to the place where they needed the more advanced intermediation. Does that sound right?
That is exactly right. And that's really the kind of things that led to that workshop.
Uh-huh.
security is a good example. There's a REST discussed mailing list, and I sort of lurk on there, and that's one of the criticisms that's usually leveled against things like, you know, that approach. That, you know, what about security or what about transactions? And the answer comes back, well, yeah, security is a bit of an issue. Transactions you just don't want to do. So it's a very different mindset. In some ways, people are talking past each other. I think the use of headers, you know, is a very well understood approach to solving the problem. Every system I've seen essentially does that. They may not be called headers, but they may be called a context. So, you know, there is a WS context. And, you know, that's, I think, one of the position papers from Mark Little, I believe, is around, you know, can this be used to kind of bridge the two worlds?
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to be very interesting. But, yeah, there's definitely this difference in mindset that I think has the two groups kind of talking past each other. And if they can just find some common terminology, common understanding of the kind of problems that each faces, I don't think it's a huge technical issue to solve. It's more of a getting the right people talking and understanding each other.
It also feels to me a little bit as though, and I don't know how it could have played out differently, but it feels as though if it had been the case that as, from an enterprise perspective, these web technologies began to be pressed into service, if it could have been possible to take an approach to bringing all of that legacy apparatus to bear on this environment. It seems like what happened is people looked at their 10 and 15 and 20 years of experience with enterprise middleware and said, aha, in one fell swoop, we're going to recreate that stuff for this environment. And, you know, we've done it before and we know how to do it. So let's just have this big bang, which I think it would be hard to argue went well. The alternative, I don't know how it could have happened, but if it could have happened in such a way that it were more incremental, well, let's start with this piece of it. Let's augment the native web stuff with just this piece of our stuff and iterate on that for a while and see how it plays and then kind of, you know, kind of bring things in as needed. I know a number of people have sort of expressed that wish. I don't know, again, if it even could have been possible, but you know, what do you think about that?
I think, you know, Mark Baker, you know, he's a very vocal REST proponent, and he's made that point repeatedly for years.
Yeah.
And if I look back at my own work, I think it was 1997, I published a paper in Communications of the ACM that was about IOP, you know, the CORBA Internet Interorg Protocol, and how that was going to be built into the Netscape browser, and that was going to mean we're going to have distributed objects across the web and turn the world on its head.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I was very, very wrong. The weird thing is, the web is distributed objects.
Yeah.
One of the original names for REST that Roy considered and rejected was the HTTP object model.
Oh, really?
It's very object-oriented, but it's very different. And I think the fact that people like me kind of went in there and said, well, you know, basically ignored what the web was, saw it as this system of pipes that let browsers get at certain things.
Mm-hmm.
If there had been more awareness of what REST was, the architectural constraints behind it, you know, why it was built the way it was, within the enterprise community, within the community that essentially built WS Star, then I think, yeah, it would have been possible to incrementally add on to it. But I think what really happened was more of how you described it, kind of like, hey, we did this over here, and it sort of worked, so we're going to try it over here, and it just didn't work. Now, the thesis for REST wasn't published till 2000.
Yes.
So people say, well, that's retrofitting, you know, REST onto the web, but that's not true because Fielding actually started that work in 93, 94 timeframe, from my understanding. It was, you know, working on HTTP 1.0 and 1.1 and URL generic syntax along the way as he was doing his thesis. So it was all done, you know, the way it should have been done,
mm-hmm.
but I think the visibility to this other crowd just wasn't there. So it's interesting, though, as you're starting to see people kind of figuring this out. So I mentioned toolkits that sort of lead developers in a certain way or down a certain path. There's a CXF project at Apache that some of my old Iona colleagues work on. There's a guy named Dan Diephouse who had written Xfire, which is part of CXF, and he's been doing some work on adding REST support into this toolkit. So basically you have your Java class and you can annotate the methods with URLs that they're responding to essentially, and
yeah.
and dealing with gets and posts and stuff like that. So he's still working on it. It's work in progress, but you're starting to see, you know, that's one example of this kind of awakening of the sort of enterprise crowd to the web.
It worries me how polarized things are, though. I mean, as you know, there are people who, at least publicly, I mean, Tim Bray, for example, you know, you get the impression from Tim, let's just tear the whole thing down, right? It was a complete waste of time. I'm rarely that extreme and always, again, sort of looking for common ground. And I worry about how polarized things are right now. Do you think we can get past that?
I think it's been worse in the past. I think it's getting better. If you look at Mark Baker again, for example, I've known Mark for many years. We used to have talks about distributed objects, and in fact, his email address, you know, is distobj, right?
Right.
And he stands by that because the web is basically distributed objects. So if you look at him, he's viewed, I think, as this very pro-REST, very anti this other stuff. And in some ways, I feel that he had to do that just to draw the right attention, that if he had gone in sort of in a middle ground and said, hey, guys, we should also be looking at this, that nothing would have happened.
Mm.
So in some ways, the polarization has opened a lot of eyes and may not have happened otherwise.
Mm.
But I think guys like Mark and Tim Bray, I've never met, but certainly read his blog and everything. They've been around for a while, and they understand that you just don't throw things out. So they may be publicly saying, let's just trash this stuff, but in, you know, if you talk to them in person, I certainly talk to Mark this way, he understands that there's this other stuff in there. It has to be dealt with. At the end of the day, Mark certainly writes production software. He's aware of these issues. So he's not just a technical purist or anything.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's actually improving. And I think what's improving it is the fact that the two camps are sort of looking at each other saying, oh, yeah, you actually do have this problem here that, gee, I'm going to have to think about how I can solve that with my approach.
Mm-hmm.
So getting better, and will continue to do so.
So here's a different question for you, but very much about distributed computation. I've, from time to time, had different notions about what I thought was going to be the fundamental unit of distributed computation. So, for example, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, I got the idea that a WS Star-style web service was going to be the unit of distributable computation, in the sense that around that time, I think, Akamai had this idea of extending their edge content delivery model to an edge services model. Do you remember that?
Right.
You'd build this service, and it would have very well encapsulated interfaces, and you would drop it into their content delivery network, and it would, just like it was a file that needed to be cached and delivered from the edge, you know, the service would propagate out and be supported in all the places where it needed to be and be load balanced and have all these other properties. Obviously, that kind of didn't happen. More recently, I've started to think that, in a funny kind of way, the virtual machine instance is that thing. Well, you see it in lots of places. I mean, I think the Amazon EC2 stuff has been a particularly eye-opening example of it. It's, in fact, it's an entire Linux instance, which is the thing that you modify, and then you freeze-dry it, and then you clone it, and then you populate it out to where it needs to be. But I think that doesn't feel quite right either, because that feels like a pretty heavyweight construct. There are other models that one can imagine. Where do you think things could go, or where do you think things will go?
Now, that's a tough one. I guess I haven't really ever thought of things in those kind of terms. I think, you know, if you look at what's made the web successful, it's a few things, but one of the important things has been this uniform interface.
Mm-hmm.
So where I think a lot of people have been thinking, and certainly in WS Star, the thinking is, again, more from a programming language developer or user of programming language, but that developer's perspective of, gee, I've got to write essentially what is an object or a class, and that thing has an interface, and I've got to make that available somehow. And it just doesn't scale. It works very well within an application. It can work well within a work group or an organization, but across the web, it just can't work because there's no way to describe that stuff. There's no way to find the descriptions reliably. And so, you know, we talk about objects and services and, you know, which is the right thing. And I think objects sort of has this background of, you know, that people look at things like COM and CORBA and stuff like that and say, well, those didn't work very well. I would argue CORBA did for what it was, what it still does today, but it didn't work in the sense of this distributed, you know, worldwide distributed system.
Mm-hmm.
But people get hung up on the term distributed object because of things in the past like that. And again, the web itself, if you look at it, is a distributed object system. And then, you know, there's this whole services thing. So do we package things as services, and, you know, what do those services look like? And then again, you run into this interface problem.
So that's exactly the question. If you look at the web today as a system of distributed objects, where those objects are these, if you will, content objects, right? So, you know, I have this HTML file. It's very much the case, actually, that I sort of drop it into the network and it winds up propagating to a lot of different places from which it can be served back out to people, right? Because of caching and intermediaries and things like that. So that object can percolate through this distributed infrastructure, and there are lots of different kinds of underlying systems at any point that are going to serve it back out, but that's all sort of transparent. So the question that I've been asking myself a lot lately is, what is the equivalent model for services, right? Things that are active rather than content, which is passive. What is the generic model for a service such that it gets dropped into the network and it, you know, has this property of propagating around and being active and doing what it does at many different points, you know, supported by many different substrates, but it being, again, in the same way that the content stuff is, all sort of pretty seamless and transparent. Because obviously right now it's not, right? I mean, our model for services, you know, is very much, you know, pick which camp you're in, right? You know, am I a .NET service? Am I a LAMP service? Am I a Java-bound service, right? And so we have this balkanization. Can we imagine something beyond that that's more uniform?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I just hadn't really considered that at all. I mean, in the past, we've certainly had discussions around the long-time argument about whether you have something that sits at an endpoint, essentially, and all the requests and data move to it, or you have something that moves around and, you know, that moves to the data, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we've seen many, many ways of doing this over the years with agents of all sorts, and Gini, you know, the Gini guys would say, of course, Gini is the answer here. You've got various, you know, sort of the old-time distributed object systems from the 80s, the groundbreaking systems where things like Emerald or Argus or, you know, things like that that investigated a lot of these issues and were essentially building whole systems,
mm-hmm,
that were languages and systems all together.
Right.
The virtual machine thing that you just mentioned is very intriguing.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely one way that you can imagine it working. So, like, just hypothetically, if you imagine an Akamai-like CDN, right, an overlay network, and the nodes of this overlay network are, let's say, running VMware, and those VMware nodes are able to receive instances of different operating systems, right? So you could actually shoot it a Linux instance or a Windows instance or what have you. And that instance would be this freeze-dried thing, which would contain within it potentially anything. It could contain within it a LAMP stack. It could contain within it a Java stack or a .NET stack, you know, or other things. But from the perspective of the outside world trying to connect to it, it would, well, you know, it would be relatively standard, right? You need to be talking to it over sockets and so on, right? And so at least conceptually, that could work. It just feels awfully clunky to me. Way more moving parts, really, then it seems like you should have to have. But you can imagine that it could work, too, right?
Yeah, I mean, clunky is a good term for it right now. When I was at Iona, you know, I'm not a Windows person. I just don't really care for that. But I've been a Unix guy for years and years and years. So I like to work on OS X. And so I've been, when I was at Iona, I had a Linux box, and I had a Windows instance in a virtual machine. That's how, if I ever had to do Windows work, I just fire up that virtual machine.
And right.
That worked reasonably well.
Right.
In my new place here, I've been trying to get a virtual machine up on a Windows box. I want to run Linux in a VM, and I just can't even get the VM to work at all. I get these authorization failures. I know a guy at VMware, kind of sent him to him and waiting for an answer.
Mm-hmm.
On my OS X box, I have Parallels installed. I just got it, and I've been trying to get a Solaris 10 image running in there, and running into trouble. I can't decide if it's Parallels or Solaris 10. So
It's all a little bit propeller headish right now, isn't it? So
yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So this whole area obviously has a lot of maturation to do.
If people are providing cloud-based services and they're the ones that have mastered the intricacies of getting these things running side by side, which it only takes one person to sort of figure it out, you know, and then that knowledge can be propagated, right? In terms of a fabric. So that's just completely speculative, and I don't really think that that's the right answer, but it's an answer that has the kind of properties that I'm looking for. Yeah, and so I think it's interesting.
It is interesting. The other thing about it, I mean, assuming we get past all those issues, which we will, no doubt about that, you still have to go back and look at this REST stuff, right? Because that's how the web works.
Mm-hmm.
REST is really about architectural constraints, uniform interface, and cacheability type constraints. That's why it's scaled like it has. That's why it works, right?
Yeah.
So this particular solution, this VM solution, would have to kind of... You have to look at it from that perspective as well. What is it that makes such a system cacheable? What's the interface with which you deal with these things? And of course, it has to be this uniform interface. What does that mean?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so in some ways, the things that are in the VM are the things that today are, you know, the typical kind of web pages and stuff. You can think of them that way, right?
Mm-hmm.
And dealing with those just works the way it does today.
Mm-hmm.
But the VM itself that you're moving around and running on these edge servers now all of a sudden also has to be obeying the constraint. And what does that mean?
I see what you mean. Yeah, that's right.
Something interesting to think about.
That's right. Well, we're not going to solve that here now. So was there anything that you had on your mind that you wanted to bring up? I mean, you're at an interesting point, right? You've had this long middleware career that's, you know, spanned, as you said, you know, the sort of CORBA phase through the web services phase, right? So you're sitting in an interesting spot to sort of reflect on, you know, where we've been and what we've learned and, you know, where we can go with all this stuff.
You know, I started my career at Texas Instruments, and I'm a hardware guy, you know, electrical engineer, right? And was working on chips, and for a few years, Over those years, I had to write more and more software just as part of my job and sort of fell in love with software. And then was doing a job at Apollo Computer that was sort of half and half, you know, half hardware, half software. That led me into some distributed system stuff. And then eventually I switched entirely into pure software and distributed systems. And for 16 years, I've done basically middleware type stuff.
Mm-hmm.
This opportunity came along, and it's more like, you know, the half hardware, half software type thing.
Hmm.
I won't be working on any hardware, but there's certainly a hardware element to it. What's interesting to me is I will now be a user of the type of middleware, the types of middleware that I was just very recently a provider of. So it's going to be interesting. I get to see what all the pain that I've put my customers through over the years. But it will be interesting because in the past I was used to having very much, you know, the knowledge of how all these innards worked and was aware of what people were doing with it, but didn't really know all the ins and outs of all their applications. Of course, you can't possibly know all that stuff.
Right.
Now I'm going to be, like, you know, having to work on applications and would like to know all the ins and outs of the stuff underneath me, but I may not have that same level of visibility.
It does raise a fascinating question, though, which is how could it be the case that providers of infrastructure software can have a better perspective on what it's like to use that stuff? Like, you shouldn't have to leave the company that makes the stuff in order to see what it's like from the other side of the fence, right?
Well, at Iona, we had a very strong sales engineering team. And, I mean, people say, generally, you get sort of these people that say, sales engineer, that's not a real engineer. That may be the case at other places. At Iona, these guys were just top-notch.
Mm-hmm.
They knew the insides, and they were always working with the customers.
Mm-hmm.
They knew the types of issues that the customer would run into.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that would have been a lot of fun to do, very challenging, but fun. But unfortunately, to do that, you have to be on the road all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I just really got burned out on traveling
mm-hmm.
years. And so in my new position, I don't have to travel at all. I have a 7-minute commute, right?
Sweet. You could ride your bike, huh?
Yeah.
Well, thanks, Steve. I will look forward to, I'm sure that at some point you will surface a blog again. And
yep, definitely.
So I'll be on the lookout for that. And thanks. This was great to talk with you.
You too.